Jacques Ellul was presented by David Crabtree at Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute, entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Jacques Ellul is our author for today. Jacques Ellul is a Frenchman born in 1912. He died in 1994. A Frenchman, he fought in the French Resistance and was actually fairly prominent in the French Resistance and fighting against Hitler's advances in France. And is I don't remember whether it shows up in the chapters that you read, but he uses Hitler as an example fairly often. He won an award from a Jewish organization for his efforts in trying to save the lives of Jews during World War II. He became a professor at the university in Bordeaux. His field is sociology. He wrote a lot of books. The list of books, boy, it must be like 50, 60 books. Only a handful of those have been translated into English. And even those are, most of those are hard to get. As a young man, he was very attracted to Marxist theory. And that continued to be a thread of his thinking. He was heavily influenced by Marxist thinking, but he ceased to be a Marxist and began to see things a little differently, that there were other dynamics at work rather than the forces that Marx had identified, and that history was actually being driven by something else, and that became his major interest and concern, is to determine what is it that's driving especially modern culture, history in our time. I don't remember all the details, and I have seen actually contradictory things in accounts of his life, but I think I recall that his father was an Orthodox priest. I think that that's true, but I'm not positive. But for most of his young life, he was not a believer, but he became a Christian midway through his life and became a member of the French Reformed Church and became a kind of lay pastor in that church. And Christianity plays a big role in his thinking. Heavily influenced by Karl Barth and Soren Kierkegaard in particular. Okay, what do you need to know about Ellul as you look at this passage and stuff that it probably would have been nice to know before you looked at the passage? The first is he's one of my heroes. The second is one of the things that's interesting about Ellul is he makes a sharp distinction between his theological writings and his academic writings. He's not afraid to say that he is a Christian, and you can see that Christian beliefs kind of permeate his whole perspective. But when he's writing academic works, he doesn't bring theology into it. You'll see this in here. He's not really bringing that in. There's a sense in which it's there, and we'll talk about that later, but he doesn't. It's not obvious. The third thing, he does not use data to prove his points. I don't think there's a number in this article. In his work on his probably most well-known work, The Technological Society, he prefaces it by saying there aren't going to be any numbers in this thing, which is atypical for for sociologists. Sociologists, it's surveys, it's quantifiable data is how you get it at the at an understanding of sociology. That is not Alul's perspective. Alul avoids the numbers because from his perspective, numbers don't lead you to the truth unaided. The numbers alone will not lead you to the truth. Numbers play a role, but they are not the main thing that helps you to understand what's going on. That is a rational activity. That takes judgment and analysis. And from his perspective, it isn't the numbers that should persuade you. It's how much sense his argument makes that should persuade you, not the numbers. The fourth thing that you need to know, he speaks in rather stark terms. He makes bold generalizations. And what he's doing is he's trying to chart out the norm. He's trying to chart out the way things are in general. And as a result, he doesn't qualify his statements. If you were to say, but I know of an exception to that, I'm sure he'd say, so what? An exception is not going to make a difference to the rule. And so what he's stating here is the rule. That's his general pattern. Fifth, and this is related actually to the third, the empirical reality is not the essence of reality. And in fact, it's very deceptive. Empirical reality is not the essence of reality, and in fact, empirical reality can be very deceptive. Just looking at things at face value, you are not necessarily going to understand what's going on. That the way things really are, especially when we're talking about sociology, when we're talking about human beings and how we function and how we relate, just looking at face value, that's not going to get you there. You've got to really think about it and think about what's going on below the surface, and that's not measurable, and that's why he's not a real fan of empirical data. And as he looks at things and sees those less obvious factors at work in our lives, he sees forces that are at work that are, first of all, rooted in who we are as human beings, bigger than any one of us, and in fact, beyond the control of any one person or any group of people, and forces that, if unchecked, would lead us to a bad end. Those are the forces that he thinks are the most primary, and those are the ones that he's most interested in. And then one of his main themes that arises from his analysis of society with these assumptions is that modern society is a new and different thing, something that we have not seen before. And in modern society, the thing that is most distinctive is that we as a culture have given ourselves over to technique. Now, I'm going to talk about this a little bit, what he means by technique. And this is what he describes in The Technological Society. And then he wrote a couple of other books, which I have not read, but several of my students have read them and have recommended them as being more accessible than The Technological Society. The most recent of those is The Technological Bluff. The Technological Bluff. Let me describe what he means by technique and what he sees happening. Technique is when we find methods for achieving things, achieving goals, that are scientifically determined, and they are the most efficient means possible for achieving an end. That's technique. So technique is basically a scientifically arrived at method for doing things. And what he argues is that human cultures over time have not always been attracted to technique. He gives us an example. Greek culture didn't like technique. They did science. They were attracted to science. But they weren't attracted to the application of science to their lives to make everything more efficient. There were Greek thinkers who would come up with inventions just because they thought it was cool, not because it was more efficient. And in fact, weren't interested in the practical application of those inventions. So that's a culture that has an allergy to technique. But other cultures have been much more receptive to technique. He says the first technique, the first area of human endeavor that was devoted to technique was magic. You try something. If it gets the right result, then that's the right thing to do. If it doesn't get the right result, then you trash that and you try a different approach, a different method. And you keep doing that and refine your magic so that it gets the results that you want. So that's technique applied to the spiritual, essentially. What has happened in Western culture is with the advent of science in modern times, with the advent of the Enlightenment, what happened is science was put to practical use, and the results in our daily lives were rather remarkable. That as man applied his scientific reasoning to, in particular, in producing things, And then selling those things, the amount of prosperity that was generated by that was stunning. And the amount of increase in production in factories was stunning. All of that was so undeniable and compelling that our culture decided we're not only going to apply technique to the industrial setting, we can apply technique to other settings. Let's apply technique to education. Let's apply technique to government. Let's apply technique to interpersonal relations, etc., etc. So more than any society before, our society has embraced technique wholesale. And that's what he calls, it's when you develop that mindset that the way to solve any problem is through a scientifically determined, most efficient means, then you are a technological society. So technique for him, it's a mindset. It's a perspective on the way life is. His complaint about technique is extremely reductionistic. Technique, in order to work, has to have measurable outcomes. How does science decide the most efficient means? Well, it has to have measurable things. And you can tell whether measurements go up or go down. And if they go up and you wanted them to go up, then that's, you're doing the right thing. If they go down and you wanted them to go up, you're doing the wrong thing. And you adjust what you're doing. So the scientific approach has to have measurable things. And so what you do is you find measurable outcomes for everything that you're doing. But the problem is, the most important things in life are not measurable. The things that are most human are not measurable. That may work great for churning out widgets out of a factory, because the reductionism there, you aren't losing anything. Well, I shouldn't say you aren't losing anything that's significant, but it's less obvious that you're losing anything significant. But when you're dealing with people, now you're losing really significant things. And in fact, you end up thinking of people in terms of, you know, they're a lot like widgets. They're very widget-like. And you start treating them widget-like. So that's his concern, and that's what he sees as the great travesty involved in technological society. Exactly, exactly. Because it's that he hates the chasing of numbers. He was at the beginning of this process of developing a scientific approach to all of life. Yeah. I've used this example many times here at Gutenberg, but some of you wouldn't have heard it, and so I'll use it for your benefit. But for accreditation purposes at Gutenberg, we have to have measurable outcomes for everything we do, and then we're supposed to track our progress towards meeting those measurable outcomes. And I have argued two tracks on a number of occasions that makes no sense to me, that because the outcomes that we want are not measurable. And as soon as you try to find a measurable outcome that approximates what you're trying to achieve, it's still just an approximation. And if you really take those seriously, then what you're going to do, your whole organization is going to start chasing those approximations of what you're trying to achieve rather than the thing that you're trying to achieve. One example is we are supposed to come up with measurable outcomes for the spiritual development of our students. And I asked them, well, how do you measure that? And one example was, one suggestion was, well, you find out how many times a day your students pray when they first come, and then you count the number of times they pray when they're done. Which, in my mind, I'm thinking, I know how we would improve our measurable outcomes. We'd have them shorten their prayers. and we can have them fast often, too. Sure, sure. Whether the chicken was first or the egg was first is difficult there. I mean, the whole the drive towards science plays into that and contributes to that, and that contributes to science, etc. Absolutely. So, from his perspective then, we have become a technological society, and technique now has taken over. Technique has become this entity in our midst that actually is taking us rather than us guiding. It's a force that's bigger than any of us. And from his perspective, it has a definite end to which it is taking us, and we're just stuck and going along with it. And that's his concern, is what could be done to mitigate that being on a train that's headed down the track. Mm-hmm. Well, I think he does have an alternative. I think he does. But he has... It's a lot like de Tocqueville's description of democracy. He sees democracy ultimately going to a bad end. But you need to understand democracy so you can slow down that progression towards the bad end. Alul sees technique as being the same kind of thing. It is headed to a bad end. The reason it's headed to a bad end is because we are bad beings. The driving force behind this is sin, I think Alul would say in his non-academic works. So it is headed to a bad end. That's because it's human beings that have put this in motion and are driving it. The solution, is on, as far as a society, the solution is understanding what's going on and resist it. But it is unresistible, ultimately. So the solution is individual rather than societal, and that's, we'll talk about that in a little bit. Well, I would say that even that, if you try to reduce it down to what is our ultimate goal? Our ultimate goal is to play whatever role we can in the lives of our students to help them to come to terms with God. And will they have an impact on society later on? I hope so. But that's in God's hands. That's not actually the goal that I'm interested in. And how do you measure whether we have done what we can to help someone to come to terms with God? And I would say that is not measurable. In fact, even superficial things, even just watching their behavior or interacting with them, that's only an indication. It takes a lot of discernment to figure out, to even make a reasonable judgment as to what's happening there. Yeah, exactly. That's the measurement I'm interested in. Okay, very quickly, let me tell you what happens, what Alula says in the book previous to these two chapters. These two chapters are the summary chapters. In the first chapter, he argues that in modern society, everything is political. We have reached the point in time in which we look to the state to solve all of our problems, and we think that as citizens, every significant problem can be solved by political means. Secondly, we have reached the point in time in which, he argues, politics are determined. What's going to happen politically is determined. That the technical solution is the only one permissible. It's the one that the experts, the technicians, advocate. In most cases, that is the political solution that is going to be adopted. He says real political decisions in our time are rare. Politics are ephemeral. The things that a politics deal with are trivial matters. Politics doesn't deal with significant kinds of things. He argues that politics are autonomous insofar as they aren't really restrained by law. If the law gets in the way, we change them. They aren't restrained by morality. If the best, most efficient solution is immoral, we'll find a way to justify it and do it anyway. Politics are not restrained by ideology. That even the most ideological politician is willing to sacrifice his ideology for the most efficient solution. And politics are not restrained by the public. Because realistically, the public is too distracted and has other things to do and is not involved enough to restrain politics. So, what he argues is that we actually have this kind of bizarre situation in which politics arise out of this world of illusions. He argues that we start out with facts, and facts are any pertinent piece of information. But most pertinent pieces of information never get anywhere. It takes either the government or some large body to elevate a fact to the position of being a political fact, that is, one that people take notice of. And when that happens, the fact is kind of extracted out, and it becomes an image more than it is a fact. Then, once it becomes a political fact, then the government responds to it. Now we've got something that the government has to respond to, and the government responds to it, but the government responds to it in a way that's kind of a charade. It's not really addressing the problem, but it's the appearance of addressing the problem that's important. So it's the image of doing something in response to an image. And then what happens is that is communicated back to the public in the form of an image. So what he argues is politics all happens in this realm of images in which nothing is quite real. And everybody is responding to something that's not quite real. So the whole process is illusional rather than substantive. He says, our control of the state, we think that we control the state, that's an illusion. It is so determined by technique that we can't have a significant impact on it. No individual and no group, at least the way things exist right now, no group can have an impact on it. Our participation in the state is an illusion. We have no significant voice, we just have the appearance of a voice. And the solutions that the state comes up with, the political solutions, those too are an illusion. They don't really solve anything. In fact, they aren't intended to solve anything. They are designed for their propaganda value rather than to actually solve problems. So what do we do? And that's what he talks about in the last two chapters. So that's our topic for discussion when we look at these chapters, and we'll come back in a little bit and talk about it some more.